Welcome to the Anesthesiology Journal podcast, an audio interview of study authors and editorialists.
Hello, I'm Bobbi Jean Schweitzer, professor of anesthesiology at Northwestern University and an associate editor for Anesthesiology. And you are listening to an anesthesiology podcast designed for physicians and scientists interested in the research that appears in our journal. Today, we are speaking with an author of a publication that appears in the May 2020 issue of the journal. With us is Dr. Martin Dreis. Dr. Dreis is the first author of an article titled Usefulness of Parasternal Intercostal Muscle Ultrasound During Weaning from Mechanical Ventilation. Dr. Dreis is at the Public Assistance Hospital, Dr. Dreis is at the Public Assistance Paris Hospital, PTA Salpêtrière Hospital, Pneumology and Critical Care Department, and the Sorbonne University, Experimental and Clinical Research Unit in Paris, France, and the Department of Anesthesia and Li Ka-shing Knowledge Institute, Keenan Research Center in Toronto, Ontario, Canada. Welcome, Dr. Dreis.
Hello, everyone. It's my pleasure to be with you.
So, Dr. Dreis, I think you actually did three different studies, all involving ultrasound evaluation of the parasternal intercostal muscles, but in different settings and for different reasons. And you reported all of these in this manuscript. Can we start with your telling us a bit about the role of the intercostal muscles in normal individuals and also in critically ill patients?
Yes, of course. So the intercostal muscles are working together with the diaphragm, which is the main inspiratory muscle in healthy subjects, but also in a patient in the ICU. And what we know until now is that these muscles are important during the inspiration, and they are not working only in case of effort. They are important during inspiration, normal inspiration, because they stabilize the chest wall during the inspiration, during the contraction of the diaphragm. And we have some data coming from the healthy subjects, but also coming from the ICU settings, showing that there is a kind of relationship between the increase in the activity of the intercostal muscle and, for instance, the level of dyspnea of a healthy subject or patient. So we thought that it would have been interesting to look at this inspiratory muscle because they have a very important role as the diaphragm does in the inspiration.
So before we get into the details of your study, can you tell us a bit about how one technically does these ultrasound examinations that you utilize?
Yes, of course. So we use the ultrasound as others have done before us by looking at the diaphragm ultrasound. So basically, we use a vascular probe, and we put the probe on the chest wall of our patient and in our healthy subject, on the anterior part of the chest wall, and we use a 2D view in order to have a direct view on the ribs and the muscles, and in particular for the intercostal muscle. These muscles are between two ribs on the anterior part of the chest wall. So basically, it's a quite easy view that you can get when you put a vascular probe on the chest wall, on the anterior part of the chest wall. You can have a direct access on these important muscles.
Thank you. So what exactly are you measuring or evaluating? And I know a picture is worth a thousand words, and you know, you did a very good job there giving us a visualization of how technically you use the probes. But is it possible for you perhaps to describe to us the ultrasound images for our listeners?
Sure. So first, if you use a 2D mode, so basically you just have to put the probe in, on the chest wall and look at the screen. So what you will see is the ribs, and between the ribs, you will see three layers that will correspond to the intercostal muscle. And the thickness of these layers is between 3 and 5 milliliters. So with this 2D view, you can switch to the time motion mode that will allow you to measure the thickness of the muscle, but also to measure the thickening of the muscle, because by using the time motion mode, you will be able to measure the change in thickness along the time.
Good. So how difficult is it to learn to do these ultrasound exams? And I know you mentioned use of vascular probe. Is everything else the same equipment that one would typically have for a central line placement?
Correct. This is exactly the same kind of probe that we used. And I don't have the definitive answer regarding the difficulty, because we did that in the context of research, and we did not really evaluate the learning curve. What I can say is that we found that quite easy, because, for instance, if we compare to the diaphragm ultrasound, the intercostal muscle is much more superficial, and it seems to us that it was more easy to get nice images and then to get some nice measurement. But this is only a feedback from myself and all the other authors of the paper. And as I said, we did not precisely evaluate the learning curve and how is it really difficult for trainees, for instance.
I understand. So if we can talk a little bit more about the parasternal intercostal muscles, I know you mentioned how they're, you know, useful even in healthy people to stabilize, I think you said stabilize the chest. So are these parasternal intercostal muscles considered what we typically talk about as accessory muscles of ventilation? Or what muscles do we use routinely, and which ones can individuals recruit?
I think it's a very important question, and I thank you for that, because it is true that for a lot of people, we call these muscles accessory muscles, which are not accessory, because they are working all along the life together with the diaphragm, and they are active during spontaneous breathing, even for healthy subjects, and of course, they will work harder if subjects are doing an effort. But I think the best way to call them is extra-diaphragmatic inspiratory muscle, because they are working during the inspiration with the diaphragm, but they are not accessory in the sense of they are not recruited only in case of effort. So the real denomination, I would say, is extra-diaphragmatic inspiratory muscle.
So now we're going to talk about your studies, and I think it's the best way maybe to go through them each individually. So with the first one, who were the subjects and what did you do? And I believe in the paper you refer to this as sub-study A.
Yes, this is correct. In sub-study A, we enrolled about 20 healthy subjects. And we just asked them to have a quiet breathing. And during this quiet breathing, we measured the thickness of their intercostal and the thickening of their intercostal. And this procedure allowed us to report what we could call normal values in women, in men as well. And we could compare this measurement to measurements made in the ICU to have an idea of what I could say abnormality in the ICU.
And what did you find?
So what we found is that, as expected, we found a very low thickening of the intercostal muscle, which is quite expected, because these subjects were breathing at rest, so they were not recruited too much their muscle. But this is an important result, because it allowed us, as I said, to compare what the critically ill patients are doing when they are breathing, for instance, during a weaning trial. So we do have, even though it's a small sample of patients, we do have some normal values of healthy subject breathing at rest, and we found a very low thickening fraction between, let's say, 2 and 5%, which is very, very low.
So what about the second study? Who were these subjects and what did you do with them? And again, I think you refer to this as sub-study B.
Yes, this is correct. So in this study, we conducted this study in our ICU. Our ICU is a medical ICU. Our patients have mainly respiratory distress or septic shock. And in this study, we enrolled the patient after 4 days of mechanical ventilation. And our aim was to evaluate the dose response of the intercostal muscle thickening fraction with stepwise increase or decrease in pressure support. So this was something that we wanted to do with in mind some similar studies performed with electromyogram.
And what did you find in this sub-study?
We found what we expected. We find a dose response, which means that when we increase the pressure support, so the patient was doing the lowest work of breathing, I would say, and what we found is that the thickening fraction of the intercostal muscle was very, very low, which is quite expected because the patient did not need to recruit and to use his extradiaphragmatic inspiratory muscle.
And what about part three? I think this was the part when you actually tried to predict the weaning success before an actual weaning trial. And I think you referred to this as sub-study C.
So in this study, we enrolled around 50 patients. At the first day, they were ready to perform a spontaneous breathing trial. And we wanted to evaluate on one part function or the activity of the intercostal muscle, and on the other part, the diaphragm function. And we wanted to evaluate the correlation between the diaphragm function on one side and the intercostal muscle activity on the other side.
So as part of this last study, I think you also, as you mentioned here, evaluated the diaphragm, but you also utilized phrenic nerve stimulation. Can you tell us how this was done and what was the purpose of that exercise?
So the phrenic nerve stimulation technique is a gold standard technique to evaluate the diaphragm function, in particular in the ICU. So how does it work? We use a magnetic stimulation of the phrenic nerves to stimulate the phrenic nerves, and we measure the response of the diaphragm in terms of pressure generating capacity. So it means that when you can provide a standardized stimulation, you are expecting a given answer in terms of pressure generating capacity. In other words, the higher the decrease in the airway pressure during the stimulation, the best the diaphragm function.
Okay, so were you able to predict weaning failures?
So yes, we could, and I have to say that this is something that is not completely new, because we have also reported, us but other team worldwide, that it is possible to predict weaning outcome by using the phrenic nerve stimulation technique, but also diaphragm ultrasound. But this is true that in our study, we could also evaluate the prediction of weaning outcome by evaluating the thickening fraction of the intercostal, and we actually could discriminate patients according to their activity of the intercostal muscle as evaluated here by the thickening fraction.
Got it. So how many total patients did you study, and how many were in each group?
So we had around 20 healthy subjects in the sub-study A. We had 16 subjects in the study B, the study in which we wanted to evaluate the dose response with the pressure support and the thickening fraction of the intercostal muscle. And in the last study, study C, we enrolled 54 patients.
Did these patients overlap? For example, were the patients in sub-study C the same ones as in the other sub-studies, or were they all independent?
No, they were completely independent. It was three independent studies.
Got it. A lot of work. So as I recall, the weaning failure rate was actually quite high. I think it was 41%. And this was after experienced critical care physicians had assessed these patients and deemed them ready for weaning, right? What were the typical criteria and methods used or are used currently to predict successful weaning?
Yeah, this is a very good question and I think an important point. I think this high proportion of patients with weaning failure is explained by our weaning protocol because we assessed readiness to wean in our patient very early. And obviously, if you do that, you would have a higher risk of patients with weaning failure. But I do think that it is important because the purpose of a weaning trial is not to be, 100% right. Because if you are only able to predict success, it just means that you are evaluating your patient too late. So this is why we have a very early approach. And obviously, if you do that, as I said, you have a higher proportion of patients who will fail. But I don't think it's a real problem because if you can, for instance, give treatment to your patient because you can also document weaning-induced pulmonary edema, for instance, I think at the end of the day, you do great because you would improve your patient. So probably this proportion of weaning failure in this paper is explained by our routine protocol that is based on a very simple criteria that relied on, oxygenation. So after we analyze patient on a daily base, we look at oxygenation with a FiO2 below 50%, PEEP below 8. We don't expect the patient is completely awake, but at least we want the sedation are decreased or stopped. And we also look at the hemodynamic status. And what we just don't want is to have, a high level of vasopressures, but we can accept that the patient has a very, very low administration of norepinephrine, for instance. So I think this is the reason why we can have this protocol, a very early weaning protocol in order to detect failure and to manage with treatment. In most of the cases, the treatment are treatment for weaning-induced pulmonary edema.
Excellent point. I hadn't really thought of it that way, but you obviously don't want to ventilate patients more than they need. And especially, I think, in this current pandemic, we're recording this remotely, safe distancing, with resources being limited. We obviously want to only ventilate patients when they need ventilated. So which performed better as a predictor, the parasternal intercostal muscle thickening or the diaphragm thickening?
We were a little bit frustrated by the result, but this is the data. And actually, both are similar. We obtained the same sensitivity and specificity for both thickening fractions. The area under the ROC curve were similar, around 0.88 for the thickening fraction of the diaphragm and intercostal. And we also tried to look at whether a combination of both indices would be good. And what we found is that if you look and you compute a ratio between the thickening fraction of the intercostal over the thickening fraction of the diaphragm, you could obtain a slightly better area under the ROC curve of 0.92. But to be honest, we did not really compare the two area under the ROC curve. So I cannot really say that the combination is better. But probably if you look at both muscles, you would have better information. So you would have a better way to evaluate your patient.
And I guess if you're doing the ultrasound there anyway, it doesn't take a large amount of extra time to assess both of them.
Sure, absolutely.
Is it easier to do one or the other, assess these by ultrasound?
We did not really evaluate that in the study, but our experience showed that it seems that the intercostal ultrasound is a little bit simpler and easier because the intercostal is much more superficial and it's much more easy to screen and to detect even for a trainee. And I know that if you want to perform a diaphragm ultrasound, sometimes it's not that easy because you can have some bad surprise and you can have some difficulties to find the diaphragm. So in our experience, we would like to say that it's much simpler to do intercostal ultrasound, but I don't have the data that will evidence this point.
Spoken like a true scientist. You have your opinions, but you want data to support them.
Without data, you just cannot say anything. So.
Mm-hmm. True. So are there other methods of evaluating muscle strength or function? And if so, can these be used? And are they being used to predict weaning success or failure?
Yes, there are many methods. But I think if we want to keep everything simple, probably the best and the most easy to perform is to measure the maximal inspiratory pressure because it doesn't require any complicated device or tool. You just have to use a one-way valve and you put that on the tip of the endotracheal tube and you connect that to a device to measure the pressure. And you, even if your patient is not able to provide a strong effort, because it's a one-way valve, if you connect that during 20 to 30 seconds, you will be able to measure the strongest effort that the patient could do. And I think, in my opinion and in my experience, that the evaluation of the maximal inspiratory pressure is probably the best way to evaluate the global inspiratory effort. So I think it's an important point because when you perform MIP, maximal inspiratory pressure, you evaluate the global inspiratory effort and not the diaphragm function or intercostal activity. But I don't think it's a big problem because what you want to evaluate is really the global effort of the patient. So probably MIP is the best to my opinion. And if you believe in that, I think evaluating the cough strength is also a good alternative. But the problem is that we don't have a real, objective evaluation of the cough. So it's always a matter of subjective evaluation. But if you believe in that, there are some new data showing that it could be a good alternative.
Speaking about the maximal inspiratory pressure, because that's often reported in pulmonary function testing, particularly, in situations of neuromuscular disease, when they're trying to assess patients who aren't ventilated. And apparently it's a very good marker or measure in that population of pending ventilatory failure. So a simple test that we've been around for a while that we can still utilize. So other than assisting with assisted ventilation weaning decisions, are there other clinical uses for this technique of ultrasound evaluation of the paraspinal intercostal muscles?
Yes, I think so. I think we have to work on that. But I could mention two clinical uses. The first one would be to evaluate the patient-ventilator interaction because sometimes it's not that easy to understand what is going on. But if you can put a probe on the intercostal of the patient during, for instance, a clear asynchrony, you could evaluate what is really happening in your patient looking at the intercostal muscle because, as we mentioned earlier, when the patient is using too much the intercostal muscle, so it means that the intercostal muscle tickling fraction is too high, it means that something is not working well. So probably this is a first clinical use in which we should go, but we have to work on that. And the second would be to evaluate the effort of the patient and maybe to tailor the ventilatory assistance, because as we discussed earlier, we don't want that the intercostal muscle work too much. So if we could evaluate the thickening, we see that the thickening fraction of the intercostal is too high, we could, for instance, try to increase the pressure support or PEEP, and see whether we could decrease the thickening fraction of the intercostal. Of course, we could also look at other easy indices or variables like the respiratory rate and also the nasal flaring of the patient. But sometimes I think we need more information, and this is here. And this is why I think the ultrasound of the intercostal could be useful.
Do you think there could possibly be a role for use of this during weaning from anesthesia or recovery from neuromuscular blocking agents in anesthetized patients before we extubate them?
I think it's a very good question, and we wanted to evaluate that. I know that a lot of people working in the operating room, they are using the train of four to evaluate the paralyzing of the patient, but sometimes we are not sure of what we are observing, and we don't know the correlation between the train of four and the contraction of the muscle. So probably this is something that we could do. This is a good study that could start soon. We were thinking about that, but we didn't start yet.
Yes, we look forward to that, if you can help us with that, because I think it's been, even though train of four is the standard of care, I think it's very problematic, and we know that it's not 100% predictive.
Sure.
So, you know, I noticed that the body mass index of your patients was actually normal, and I think the average was only 24 or 25, with the largest ones having a BMI of only 28. Unfortunately, many of the patients that we take care of here in the United States are much more obese than that. In fact, we routinely have patients with BMIs greater than 40 and in some in excess of 60. Can we obtain adequate ultrasound images in these kinds of obese patients?
Honestly, I don't have a clear answer. What can I say is that the intercostal muscles are much more superficial as the diaphragm. So we had some obese patient, and we could obtain some images, but obviously we did not have a patient with a BMI of 50 or 60. I'm sure we did not. And I try to recall if I tried to do that in an obese patient, but I don't think so. So I cannot address really your question. The only thing I can say is that because it's more superficial, theoretically, you should be able to see something, but this has to be proven.
So what more do you think needs to be done before this type of assessment can be reliably used?
Yeah, this is a good point, and I think it's also true for diaphragm ultrasound, because there is a lot of interest in respiratory muscle ultrasound in general, for the diaphragm and intercostal, but also for abdominal muscles. And to be honest, I don't think that we are really ready to go to the clinical field. I think until now it's good for research. Sometimes we can try to use it for clinical purposes, but we really need the help of, you know, industrials to improve the feasibility, the precision of the technique, and also, you know, we need some engineers to develop, algorithm to obtain some automatic detection of the effort to make sure that what we are measuring is really an increase of the muscle, a thickening of the muscle, and not something that could be an artifact. And for that, we really need the help and the endeavor of all the companies that are working on ultrasound. So this is up to them. I think now, if we really want to jump and to go into the clinical field, as it is done for the cardiac ultrasound.
A call to action. I hope today's discussion will interest many of our listeners and lead you to read this important article to learn more. Thank you, Dr. Jace, for discussing your work with us today. I wish you well as you continue your efforts to enhance the practice of anesthesiology and strive to improve the care of our patients.
Thank you very much.
You've been listening to the Anesthesiology Journal Podcast, the official peer-reviewed journal of the American Society of Anesthesiologists. Check anesthesiology.org for an archive of this podcast and other related content.